Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for Thursday, the 28th of May. Our guest this hour is an ecologist, an author, and a cancer survivor, and she has an important piece in the current issue, the May-June issue of Orion magazine, Nature, Culture, and Place. She says in the article, as part of her work, she visits a lot of college campuses, and lately she's been asking students to engage in a thought exercise. Imagine that ecological metrics were as familiar to us as economic ones. Imagine ecological equivalents to the Dow, NASDAQ, and S&P that reported to us every day in newspapers, on radio, on websites, on the crawl at the bottom of TV screens, on oversized tickers in Times Square, data about the various sectors of our ecological system and how they are faring. What are the atmospheric parts per million of carbon dioxide today? Has the extinction rate become inflationary? What's the exchange rate between sea ice and fresh water? What's the national deficit of topsoil? What if we were as interested in all of these, and why aren't we, I guess, is another question, as we are in the Dow Jones, etc. Sandra Steingraber is the author of Living Downstream, An Ecologist Looks at Cancer and the Environment, and Having Faith, and her recent article is Three Bets on Ecology, Economy, and Human Health in the current issue of Orion magazine. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Sandra, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Let's start with 30 years ago, as you do in your article, when you were diagnosed with cancer, because it certainly has guided where your life has gone for the past 30 years.
Well, it has, and in that, I don't think I'm atypical of anyone who gets a cancer diagnosis. But when a diagnosis strikes you when you're 20, then it not only has the power to make you feel like you're in a kind of parallel universe with your health from all your peers, but also has the power to kind of put you on a different career track, which is what happened to me.
Mm-hmm. 20 years old and diagnosed with bladder cancer, that must have knocked you out.
It did and it didn't. You know, I was a young biologist, and I was a part of this high-achieving pre-med pack. If you knew a rat who needed a tracheotomy, I was your girl. And so my training in biology allowed me to get into the medical literature. And, of course, this was before Google and the Internet. This is 1979. And so I found out that bladder cancer is considered a quintessential environmental cancer with strong evidence going back 100 years. And yet the chemicals linked to bladder cancer had never been divorced from our economy once they had been discovered to cause bladder cancer. So I became really interested in the disconnect between the evidence that we know as members of the scientific community and what cancer patients are actually told, because very few of my doctors or other healthcare providers or my other fellow bladder cancer patients, most of whom were age 70 or above, we just didn't have those kind of conversations. So that was bewildering to me as a young biologist, I would say. On the other hand, I was not the first person in my family to get cancer. My mom was already diagnosed with metastatic breast cancer. She was in treatment at the same time I was, and her prognosis was always more grim than mine. And my aunt died of the same kind of bladder cancer I had. But I'm adopted, and that's the punchline to my family
story. That's a punchline, right.
Yeah, and so I knew that this presumption that what runs in families runs in genes really needed to be examined. So I made a kind of lateral move with my life. I didn't want to go to medical school anymore. I didn't want to spend any more time in hospitals than I had to as a patient. I didn't want it to be my workplace. So I went into research instead, and not surprisingly then, looking at the links between environment and human health became the focus of my career.
Mm-hmm. And you learned later, you say in your article, while researching your book, Living Downstream, that the county where you grew up has statistically elevated cancer rates. Tell me about the link, the research that you did, and what you think about whether or not that caused your cancer.
All right. Well, you know, I'm a sample size of one. So as a biologist, I look at myself and say it's impossible to identify for myself what all the contributors were. We know that any tumor could have 8 to 10 different mutations involved in it, and those could come from a variety of places. On the other hand, I was the clean living winner of the local Elks Club scholarship, you know, so I didn't have a lifetime of hard drinking, smoking, drug use, stressful, you know, I was a pretty clean living girl. And so I knew that there were no lifestyle explanations for my disease. And as an adoptee, unfortunately, I'm barred from understanding and knowing my genetic ancestry, so that was some data I didn't have available to me. But on the other hand, as a biologist, I was able to look at the data on populations and as a group learn that bladder cancer rates among women are rising. And when where you see bladder cancer and other kinds of cancers clustering, in other words, the map of cancer is not a random tragedy. There are links and reasons for further inquiry to look into the environment. So bladder cancer tends to be higher in counties like mine, where there are bladder carcinogens in the drinking water wells, where there are toxic waste sites. And that's not only true for people, but you can look at bladder cancer in dogs and see some of the same patterns, some of that data come out of Pennsylvania. And we also know that if you look at other kinds of cancers, like non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, they tend to cluster in counties where agricultural use is intense, and we use a lot of weed killers. So none of these correlative patterns are proof of cause, but they certainly give us reason to do more inquiry in the scientific community.
And Sandra, if we know that carcinogens can cause cancers, why is it that they are still used in commerce? I mean, I don't understand this. If we know that there's a link here, why are all these chemicals still on the market?
Well, the answer to that is long and complicated, and I'll try to make it as breezy as possible. There's definitely we have a regulatory system that controls toxic chemicals, and it's broken up by several agencies. So there's no one organization in our federal government that looks and regulates all of these chemicals. But the law that covers most of them is the Toxic Substances Control Act. That was started in the mid-70s, and it, first of all, grandfathered in all chemicals already on the marketplace. So that means that no testing or anything was required for them. They got a free pass. And then, so it governed all the new chemicals that came on the market since the late 1970s. And even then, the law does not require advanced testing before marketing. It simply requires that the manufacturers submit data to the Environmental Protection Agency, and the Environmental Protection Agency can use models to kind of guess whether or not this is going to create a problem or not. Moreover, there's nothing in the law that requires the discovery through careful scientific study of a new route that by which a chemical might cause or contribute to cancer. There's nothing in the law that requires that evidence to then change the regulatory status of the chemical. In other words, the regulatory apparatus is deaf to the emergence of new science. So it's a broken regulatory system. So on the one hand, we have this piling up of data in the world of science that indicates strong evidence that certain chemicals are linked to science, but there's nothing in our regulatory system that requires that evidence to change what we do. And that's why a lot of us are really pushing to rehaul and redo our toxic regulatory system so it is more science-based. And in that task, we have a good model already, because Europe has moved in a much different direction by embracing the precautionary principle and by also requiring all chemicals, even the ones that have been on the market for centuries, to now undergo rigorous testing. And if they are shown to be inherently toxic, then there's a whole series of steps in place for their restriction or even their abolition.
Mm-hmm. You say in the article that you have two children now, that you are betting that chemical reform will be a cornerstone of a new environmental human rights movement. Tell me about your hope, and tell me about the elements of that movement.
All right. Well, first of all, you know, I understand my autobiography is not the usual. I became a cancer patient at 20 and a mother on the brink of 40. Nevertheless, I feel very blessed. And so for me, having lived such a medicalized life, when I became joyfully pregnant with my daughter, Faith, who's now 10, I just had an ecstatic experience with just really enjoying the biology and the opera of embryonic development, feeling my body growing this good thing rather than a bad thing. I really did lie down on the same ultrasound table where I had once been scanned for signs of tumor, and now, you know, had to remember that if they see signs of growth this time, it's good, not bad, you know. And so I tried to have as unmedicalized childbirths as possible. I didn't want anesthesia, sedatives, you know, the IV drips, all the things I'm so familiar with. I wanted all that away from me. And I think I kind of managed to do that. I joyfully breastfed my children for a lot of years and really enjoyed their development and the whole symbiotic relationship that I had with them when I was pregnant and nursing. So with that as a kind of, you know, the joyful backstory of my motherhood, I turned my attention as a biologist then to looking at the ability of chemicals not just to enter the body of adults and alter hormonal status or alter chromosomal activity in ways that put cells on the pathway to tumor formation. I became really interested in how chemicals could enter the bodies of human fetuses and infants and children in ways that alter their actual development. And the science here is emerging, but very distressing, with evidence indicating that early life exposures to chemicals not only raise the risk for adult cancers, but can alter the way the brain is developed, extinguish human intelligence, can raise the risk for learning disabilities, for autism, and can bring about early puberty in girls. And so now my research is really focused on this emerging field of environmental pediatrics.
Mm-hmm. And in this, you hope to enlist the support of the pro-life community as well, which makes perfect sense, right?
Yes, and it's a tricky tightrope to walk. In fact, my forthcoming article in Orion is just about that conversation that I'm trying to have. Yes, it's an essay in which I'll tell this my story of my own abortion. My pregnancy with Faith was not my first pregnancy, and when an early ultrasound showed that this pregnancy was almost certainly not going to end happily, my husband and I made the very wrenching decision to terminate the pregnancy and had to run a gauntlet of protesters to get access to a Planned Parenthood clinic to do that. So I myself have both feet firmly planted in the pro-choice camp. And nevertheless, the data and the evidence indicating that environmental exposures to certain chemicals by pregnant women can raise the risk for certain kinds of birth defects, raise the risk for early pregnancy loss, what a woman would experience as a miscarriage, and can raise the risk for preterm birth, which is the leading cause of infant mortality and disability in this country, that all this evidence really needs to be laid at the feet of the pro-life community, because abortion means a lot more than a woman walking into a Planned Parenthood clinic like I did and willfully terminating a pregnancy. A spontaneous abortion refers to all the loss of fetal life that's happening because of our economy's dependency on inherently toxic chemicals. Now, this is a message I should say I'm also bringing to the pro-choice community, of which I'm a member, and I'm doing a lot of work right now with Planned Parenthood. They have a wonderful program called Planet Green, in which the various Planned Parenthood affiliates are looking at environmental threats to women's fertility and to healthy pregnancy outcomes. So I'm kind of talking to both communities. I'm not really interested in strengthening the hand of the pro-life community. Nevertheless, there are people who are quite sincere and members of my own family who are very pro-life, who really do believe in the paramount importance of fetal sanctity. And if that's what you believe, then I think you need to take a look at this evidence.
Mm-hmm. You do say, and is this because you see this or you have to believe this through your children's eyes, that you do believe that our grandchildren will look back on us and marvel that our economy was once dependent on chemicals that were killing the planet and killing ourselves? You do believe that?
I do.
What makes you believe that?
Well, I mean, at this point, are not only the things that you and I have been talking about now about chemical reform and its ability to harm human health. Not only is that part of the environmental crisis, but of course, there's another aspect of this crisis, which is that the ability of some of these same chemicals or other related chemicals that come out of a barrel of oil, most harmful chemicals are petroleum-based or coal-based chemicals, and so is our transportation and energy system. And so they're not only harming ourselves, but they're now threatening threatening the whole life support system of our planet through global climate change, which is beginning to make the Gulf Stream wobbly, which is beginning to collapse the ecosystem of the oceans, which provide us half of our planetary oxygen supply. So both of these twin interlocked crises, the crises of human health and the crisis involving the planet, I think is the biggest human rights problem of our time and requires our urgent attention. I think a lot of people are so overwhelmed by the enormity of the crisis that they can't even look at it, which is probably the biggest obstacle in the United States right now that we have for change. So I'm always looking as a scientist in the public health, in the public's interest, in ways that I can compel people to take a hero's role here and look at some very disturbing evidence. So just in the same way that my father, who fought Hitler in World War II, had to confront, in his generation, had to confront global fascism, our generation needs to confront this crisis and not get a case of the vapors over it, you know, and not say, oh, my God, it's so depressing, what can I do? I mean, that's not the approach we took to global fascism. We had to engage it, and we have to engage this. And so if we do it successfully, then I think our grandchildren will look back on the time in which we're now living, which I think is the end of about a 100-year period of a dependency on fossil fuels to do everything for us, heat our homes, deliver our food, drive us around, make our nail polish and our pesticides that we use in the backyard. And they'll look back on how we were so dependent on chemicals that were killing ourselves and killing the planet and so blind to that, that it will seem unbelievable to them. You know, I just was a chaperone on a field trip with my daughter. We went down to Williamsburg, Virginia with her class and spent some time in that living museum looking at plantation life. And, it was unthinkable to us that women could be tried as witches, that slaves lived with masters and in ways that just seemed so horrible and so wrong. You know, we looked at the prison where people were kept in the stockades where they were tortured. And to realize this was really part of American life, it seems so unbelievable to us now. And I think I can imagine looking, you know, a couple generations from now, people looking back and wondering how we could have put so many cancer-causing chemicals and birth defect-causing chemicals, collapsing the planet, destroying our own health, and wow, isn't life better now? I think that's what they will think.
Our guest this hour is Sandra Steingraber, an ecologist, author, and cancer survivor, author of Living Downstream, an ecologist looks at cancer in the environment and having faith, and she has a wonderful article in the current issue of Orion Magazine, Three Bets on Ecology, Economy, and Human Health. Here's the number, 800-486-8655, only one line open right now, if you want to get it. The email address is talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for Sandra, and let's start with Kate from Hebron, Illinois. Hi, Kate.
Hi. Hi, Sandra. Thanks for taking my call. I just want to say I read Having Faith, and I kind of stumbled upon it shortly before getting pregnant, and I found it really invigorating and inspiring. I'm a farmer's wife, so a lot of the things are especially timely for me. And I liked the hopeful tone at the end of it. It really influenced, I think, a lot of the way that I was thinking about my pregnancy and other people's pregnancies all across the world. So I just want to say I love the book. And I also was wondering, Sandra, if you could kind of update, since the publication of that book, have we made any progress towards mercury? Have we made any progress towards POPs, traveling north towards the North Pole. I'd be kind of curious about what progress we've made.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I'm glad the book was useful to you. That book came out in 2001 and it is named after my 10-year-old daughter Faith, and it's the story of my own pregnancy, but also as a cancer survivor, but also tells this story of embryonic development month by month and how chemicals can kind of sabotage that story. And mercury and persistent organic pollutants are two problems I do highlight in the book. And I'm happy to say that there's quite a lot of progress subsequent to the publication of the book, but sadly, mostly in other places, not the United States. So the persistent organic pollutants, there's now a treaty, the Stockholm Convention on persistent organic pollutants. It's international law. Unfortunately, the U.S. is not a signatory, is not a party to that treaty. But has nevertheless made great strides in phasing out the production and use of 12 of the most toxic persistent chemicals on the planet, and there have just been a whole batch of new chemicals that are added to that list. That just happened earlier this month, actually. And then the problem of mercury, I think, of course, burning coal is our number one contributor of mercury. Coal is naturally contaminated with mercury, and so when it's dug out of the ground and shoveled into an oven and lit on fire to generate electricity, that mercury goes into the atmosphere. It then rains out, and as carbon groups are added to that mercury, it turns elemental mercury into methyl mercury. And it's methyl mercury we really need to worry about. That's a very potent brain poison. Finds its way into fish, and so eating fish is actually our number one route of exposure. The reason you can't eat a lot of fish in Wisconsin anymore is because of mercury, and the same is true for us here in New York State. So I make a big case in Having Faith that this is really a violation of women's rights, because eating fish, especially in pregnancy, is supposed to be good for you, and now women cannot women who are pregnant or thinking about getting pregnant someday, which is essentially almost all women before the age of menopause, are now advised to eat no sport-caught fish, meaning no fish caught in the whole of the eastern United States from the east of the Mississippi to the Atlantic, and to limit their consumption of tuna fish and seafood in general. I think this is an incredible violation of women's rights and children's rights, because fish has omega-3 fatty acids. It's supposed to be good brain food, but we've so contaminated it with mercury, which is a brain poison, that it actually sabotages fetal brain growth development. It actually paralyzes migrating fetal neurons. And so there's a lot of attention now in trying to get us into renewable energy sources, right? And the pressure for that is not coming from mothers of children who have special needs kids or teachers who don't want any more kids in remedial education. Mercury does extinguish human intelligence, and so there's an argument to be made from human rights grounds, I think, on moving us to renewable energy. But nevertheless, because of climate change, the pressure is coming to leave coal behind and to move into renewables, and that's fine with me. There are many paths up the mountain, and I'm happy if the argument is made, because it's also a perfectly good argument, that we need to get off of coal for other reasons. And I think they're further ahead of us in Europe than here, but the conversation certainly is starting. And the new worry now is mercury coming from Asia as rapidly industrializing areas of China begin to embrace coal. So that it is a worldwide problem.
You would think that the statement that you shouldn't eat fish, a warning that you shouldn't eat fish, would be such a wake-up call to everybody to profoundly examine what we're doing wrong, because that's a big thing. People have existed on fish. Fish is supposed to be good for your heart. It's good for your brain. And all of a sudden to get this kind of warning, we're not taking it in deeply enough. It's striking to me.
Well, I think that's right. And I grew up in central Illinois and spent all my vacation time in Wisconsin. And when I was a kid, you could eat as much fish out of Wisconsin lakes as you wanted. And for my family, it was Chautauqua, which is where we vacationed and ate a lot of fish out of Chautauqua. And just in my lifetime, and I'm turning 50 this year, that story has completely changed. And my husband grew up in Connecticut, and he has all kinds of fond memories of fishing with his dad in all kinds of streams and rivers, not far from Norfolk, and yet that's you can't do that anymore. And so, yeah, within the last 50 years, fish is now off limits for women and children.
Kate, thanks for your call. Frank from Madison is next. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Kathleen.
Hi, Frank.
Thank you for your guest, and thanks to your guest for her voice. It's a very positive one. Could I ask the guest to address something that someone else said, which was that pessimism is not an option? Lord Stern has pointed out to the costs of getting off the carbon economy as being relatively small, and the costs of continuing with it, in addition to petroleum-based chemical consumer society, not just using coal and oil as fuel, are very, very high. So the objection that if we try to do something, we'll be harming our economy is spurious. So thank you, and thanks to your guest again.
Thank you, Frank.
Bye.
Bye.
Well, the guest raises a good point. There's a lot of different economic analyses now, not only on a carbon-based economy, but also on a pesticide-based agricultural system. So when you take a look at all the externalized costs, for example, of the current way we grow our food, including poisoned honeybees, contaminated groundwater, the cost of getting nitrates and atrazine out of tap water that is passed on to the water utilities, you add all these things up, and there's a Cornell agroeconomist who's actually done the math on this. It turns out that our cheap industrial food is actually quite expensive. You just don't pay the cost at the supermarket checkout lane. You pay it in your taxes. You pay it in higher insurance premiums. And, of course, future generations pay it because now the dead zone in the Mississippi, from the all the farm chemicals in the Mississippi River that go out into the Gulf of Mexico, that dead zone is now sinking the shrimp industry in Louisiana. So we're passing costs along rather than paying the cost of the cheap food that in our industrial system produces. And so there's that analysis. And then there's, of course, the economic analysis the caller refers to on how much is our carbon-based energy and transportation system really costing us, and it's far more than what we pay at the pump, of course. And the Europeans have done a really nice economic analysis when they promulgated their new law on toxic chemicals, which is far more progressive and science-based than the one we have here. It's been in enforcement now for a few years, and part of the rationale was realizing that the increased costs of over 30 years of health problems such as infertility, asthma, birth defects, preterm labor, cancer, that all these things to which environmental contaminants contribute create such a burden of health care costs that those costs could be recouped by simply detoxifying the economy and getting these chemicals out of the economy in the first place. And so the billions of dollars that they're spending up front to find non-toxic substitutes for toxic chemicals, that money is going to be recouped over the long haul by having fewer educational costs and fewer medical costs. And so just from a purely bloodless economic point of view, it makes sense to get us off of carbon.
Thanks very much, Frank, for your always thoughtful questions. We go next to Bruce from Oshkosh. Hello, Bruce.
Thank you, Kathleen. And Sandra, you are brilliant, and thank God you survived that early diagnosis. My mother was not so fortunate. The reason I called is because about 10 years ago, I saw a bar graph map of the state of Wisconsin showing a different bar for each kind of cancer as it went along. And as you looked at the map, it looked like a Rocky Mountain range along our riverbanks. All of the bars were high along the rivers. I also know that the city water treatment plants do not take the drugs out of the water. They take the solids, but they don't take the chemicals that we put in the water after drugs go through our bodies. And so they are causing some problems, especially among young persons. Sandra, I do want to commend you for your work, and I hope that the press and even the public television will show the bar graph map of Wisconsin soon to the public again. It's at least 10 years old, and I'm sure there have been some changes. Thank you again, Sandra.
Well, thank you. I don't know the data on cancer statistics in Wisconsin very well, so I can't comment on that. But I do encourage folks there to pay attention now to what's going on with the dredging of the Fox River. The PCB problems there, of course, are longstanding, and there is now finally money available for remediation. But this is billions of dollars of money going. We're cleaning up the Hudson now. We're finally dredging the Hudson here in New York. So simultaneously in Wisconsin and New York State, now we're getting PCBs out of river sediments where they continue to seed themselves, these carcinogens, into our airspace, into our fish. And yet there is no perfect solution here. It's a little bit of a shell game because we're going to dredge them out of the river, and then we're going to have to store them indefinitely somewhere. And I think the ongoing unsatisfying remediation of both the Fox River in Wisconsin and the Hudson here in New York really point to an upstream solution. We really need to stop making chemicals that are inherently toxic, that we know get inside our bodies, and that are very persistent. These chemicals should have no role in our economy. We don't make PCBs anymore. We stopped making them the year I was in high school, and yet they're still among us because they last such a long time. So I think it's a parable for our times. As we watch these rivers get dredged, the lesson here should be we need to go all the way up to the tap and turn the tap off, because once they're out into the natural world, it becomes an almost impossible situation.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about this thought exercise that you have students do as you speak all over the country. Imagine ecological equivalents to the Dow, NASDAQ, and Standard & Poor's that reported to us every day through our variety of communication means right now. What would be the ecological equivalent, Sandra?
Well, for example, a lot of us in ecology world spend a lot of time talking about the parts per million of carbon dioxide in our atmosphere, and these numbers are very familiar to us. Bill McGibbon, I think, has done a great job. He's a journalist, actually, Middlebury College, has done a great job in trying to get some of these metrics out to the public. So 350 parts per million is the level of carbon dioxide we think we need to get the atmosphere back to in order to avoid the most catastrophic changes. We've far exceeded that now. And so the attempt is to get us back to that level. Even that is far elevated over what it was in pre-industrialized times. So that would at least give us a chance at not altering our climate to the point where it's completely unrecognizable to anything that humans have ever evolved to live within. So we have all these internal discussions, and yet I don't hear people walking around saying, what's the parts per million of carbon dioxide today? You know, where are we on this line, right? And yet my son, who's 7, woke me up last September saying, Mama, the Dow fell 700 points. Well, you know, he doesn't know what the Dow is, but yet we're just barraged day after day with, you know, following the metrics of the economy. And even though a lot of us don't even have a direct stake in those numbers because we don't have investments, we don't play the stock market, and yet we all are aware, whether we have investments or not, that we all rise and fall together here. So if the Dow crashes, none of us can retire, right? None of us have an income. And yet it's even more true that if the carbon dioxide levels don't crash, we're all in trouble in a much bigger way. Mm-hmm. Because we need oxygen, and the plankton in the oceans make half of it for us. So if, as we now know, the oceans are on track to become so acidified that calcium carbonate goes into solution, that means we're losing the carbon sink of the oceans. That means no more coral reefs. That means no more clams, no more oysters. Diatoms have calcium contained in them, too. They make, you know, that's part of the whole food chain that provides us our planetary oxygen. So where are we on that slope of that line? How acidic are the oceans? How are they this month compared to last month, this year compared to last year? Could we have, you know, a ticker tape of that going across the crawl of the bottom of our television screens on a daily basis?
Let's welcome more phone calls in a moment. Sandra Steingraber is our guest. She has a wonderful article that appears in the current issue of Orion magazine. It's Three Bets on Ecology, Economy, and Human Health. She is a cancer survivor. She was diagnosed with bladder cancer 30 years ago between her sophomore and junior years of college. She is an ecologist and a prolific author. Living Downstream, one of her books, An Ecologist Looks at Cancer and the Environment, and also Having Faith, another of her works. Our number is 800-486-8655. If you want to send an email, that's talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll go to an email now. Steve in Milwaukee. Finally, Wisconsin passed legislation, Sandra, to curtail the use of phosphate fertilizers on lawns. Unfortunately, too many of us live downstream from neighbors who are lawn lovers, and the lawn lovers too often are using pesticides, herbicides, and fungicides that are still quite legal. Could you comment on lawn chemicals? How many people have been killed by lawn poisons?
Gee, I don't know if we have statistics on that. What I can comment on is that, you know, lawn chemicals are actually used at higher concentrations than farmers use farm chemicals, and they are a leading source of water contamination. And a lot of these chemicals are inherently toxic. Our neighbors to the north, Canada, their version of our American Cancer Society, called the Canadian Cancer Society, together with their Association of Family Physicians, took a look at some troubling data linking lawn chemical use to brain tumors in children, and decided that while more research, of course, always needs to be done to confirm and corroborate those trends, that the weight of the evidence was strong enough that all of Ontario now disallows lawn chemicals. It's called cosmetic use of pesticides. In other words, if you're not growing food with pesticides, if you're just using it to make your lawn free of crabgrass or dandelions, you're no longer allowed to use chemicals.
Oh, isn't
and in
that
fact,
something?
Chemicals
huh.
were pulled. Lawn chemicals have been pulled off the shelves of lawn and garden centers now, as of April, Ontario and also in Quebec. And then there are other municipalities throughout Canada who have signed on to the law. The Canadian Supreme Court has already. You know, there was, of course, lawsuits by chemical manufacturers, and the Canadian Supreme Court sided with the ban of lawn chemicals. And of course, there's yet another attempt by a pesticide manufacturer to sue under the North American Free Trade Agreement, calling this kind of a barrier to trade. So we'll see how it goes. But nevertheless, right now in Canada, from where most people live in Canada, there's no lawn chemical use anymore. And I think that's not very well known here in the United States.
No, it sure isn't.
And we, you know, it's really interesting to me as a biologist that we take a look at the same data that Canadians have available to them, and we say, well, troubling but not enough proof, so let's go on and keep using them until more proof emerges. To me, as a mom, I say, you know, look, I'm not interested in my kids being part of an uncontrolled human experiment here. Let's keep people away from harm first, and then let the wheels of scientific proof-making grind slowly onward. And I think that kind of precautionary approach is what all parents do, right? You know, in my household, you don't ride your bike without a bike helmet. And if you do, your bike goes into the barn for a week. And if we're swimming in the lake and I hear even the remotest thunder in the distance, I call my kids out of the lake. I don't need absolute proof that they're going to get struck by lightning. I just need to know this is an inherently dangerous situation, and I'm going to take precautionary action to keep my children safe. I think that kind of principle of precaution needs to be the basis for our federal policies, not this kind of let's just recklessly ignore science and go forward until people are dropping dead. And we have so much health and human suffering that we finally retroactively and in a reactionary way finally do something about that. I mean, that kind of proof-making requires the death of children before we change our policies, and I think that's wrong.
Which is crazy. Yeah, of course it's wrong. Crazy. Virginia from Milwaukee, hi.
Well, good morning to you both. And Sandra, I just want to tell you, you are such an eloquent speaker. We should have had you there at Toastmasters last night. I gave my talk on blue-green algae. And are you familiar with that? And it's found prolifically in only one place in the world, and that is in Klamath Lake, Oregon.
No, I don't know much about it.
Well, the book is by Professor Carl Abrams, and it's all about the blue-green algae and how it... It gives us hope for the interim now, anyway. Consuming it will, there is so much benefit, I can't even go into it because time doesn't allow, but one of the things is that it can remove the toxins from our bodies and the heavy metals. I've known about it for about 8 years, and I've been consuming it that long, excuse me. So that's what I feel is my protection, and of course, you're working at trying to eat what we might hope is organic food. Sometimes you just don't even know if that's truly organic, too. But at the same time, as I said, in consuming the algae, which I do every day, excuse me, I do it with apple juice, and it's kind of like a mild spinach flavor. But the whole point here I'm making is the title of the book is Algae to the Rescue.
Okay, thank you very much for your call, Virginia. Which brings up the point, what do you do to counteract all that's around? Do you make sure you have an organic diet, Sandra? Are you big into vitamins? What do you do?
I do less than what most people probably think that I do, because I really am focused on making public health policy change. It may be true that things like blue-green algae, I don't know. You know, it may be true that there's health benefits. There are people who have called in similar talk shows that I've been interviewed on making a similar case for mushrooms or for saunas, you know, and I don't know what the evidence is that these things work or don't work. I'm glad people have found something that's useful to them. Nevertheless, I'm really interested in getting chemicals out of our economy, out of our food, out of our water, so that kids can be born free of toxic chemicals in their bodies. And so I'm spending less time trying to keep my family inside a toxic-free bubble, and a lot more time, you know, briefing Congress on what I think they
right.
should do. Having said that, I do buy all organic food for my family, and that's because I really want to direct my food dollars toward farmers who are not broadcast spraying chemicals linked to cancer, birth defects, and learning disabilities throughout the environment. And happily, living here in the Finger Lakes area, I live in a little village called Trumansburg, and within half a mile, we have organic farms, one of which is a CSA, a community-supported agricultural farm, that my husband and I are shareholders in. So we only... you know, ride our bikes half a mile to the north and pick green beans and pick up our share. And so my kids know where their food comes from and have a stake in making sure that it rains so our carrots get a drink, you know, that sort of thing. and consequently, they're good eaters. We don't have television. They're not advertised to by the food industry. So their experience with food is completely mediated by what we pick and what we buy from the farmer's market. And, I certainly don't have fussy eaters. You know, I'm a working mother. I travel 100 days of the year.
Oh my goodness!
And so I don't have time to make my life inconvenient. But I actually find it more convenient to buy food right off the farm, to can it, to freeze it. I think Barbara Kingsolver, my colleague, writer and biologist, is right about this. You know, a can of tomatoes. in a ball jar in your basement is fast food in the middle of January. You just open it up, and within 20 minutes, you can have vegetable soup, you can have spaghetti, whatever you want. So we spend a lot of time in the summer preparing food and putting it up. But, you know, I'm a farmer's, I'm from a farm family, so that's not unfamiliar to me.
Sure.
But my kids are proud that our food doesn't, you know, we don't spend fossil fuel dollars shipping lettuce to us from California. We eat seasonally and we eat right here. So I'm teaching my kids good values. It doesn't cost me any more, and it's no less convenient. So I'm always looking for those three things as a really busy working mother.
Right. And how are you now? I know you've got to be living watchfully, as you say in your article, and have for a long time now. How are you? Are you healthy now? Feel good?
Well, I think, you know, the cancer is always all around you whenever you're diagnosed. There are very few cancers in which you're cured and you are returned back to your old life and you never have to worry again. So the whole idea of cancer survivorship is a little bit off. And so, I'm lucky. I've had mostly good news in my checkups. I've had bad news over the years. But happily, because I'm under such intense medical surveillance, most of the bad things have been caught earlier. The essay, Three Bets, opens with the scene of me getting some bad news from the pathology lab. That happened last September. And I don't have any updates yet. I'm still in that place where a lot of cancer patients live their lives, which is one of waiting for lab results. You know, it's not like you get these results and you're either fine or you're not fine. Very often you get ambiguous results and you have to come in for more tests and you wait for the results. And depending on what they show, they'll try a different test or they'll try this imaging thing. And so you live a lot of your life out not really sure if you're fine or not fine. And that's where I am right now. I had some not fine news in September, and we're still trying to figure out what it means. Mm-hmm. So I'll be going back in another week to my urologist to, you know, do some more figuring out. And usually cancer patients, when we're in those places, which is most of the time, we don't talk about them because people react wrongly. Either they say, oh, my God, I heard you had a recurrence, and then you have to spend a lot of energy, like, correcting them on that. Or they'll say, oh, I'm so glad you're okay, which is also not the case. And so we usually draw a veil of silence and secrecy around the ambiguous periods of our life. But I've decided to kind of live my life out loud and pull back that curtain so that people, so I can kind of bear witness to the large number of months of ambiguity that cancer patients actually live their life in, even 30 years after your diagnosis. You know, my mom is still alive. She had metastatic breast cancer in 1974, and I tease her that she's like Elizabeth Edwards without the television cameras. She had breast cancer that spread to her bones. And so she's part of, you know, 8% of women with that diagnosis who are still alive decades later. Well, she just had a biopsy on her lymph nodes in her neck, and, you know, that could have been really bad. It was benign. We just found that news out, you know, a couple weeks ago. She had a PET scan. There's a nodule in her lung. We still don't know what that is, so she's going to go back for more scans. And so for my mom and me, and for anybody who's had cancer for a long time, this is your life. And so there's no real way of saying you're fine or not fine.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So you kind of, the way I deal with it is that it's a kind of a high wire act. So I don't want to feel like I'm waiting for the other shoe to drop. But on the other hand, I can't afford not to be vigilant. So medically, I act like I have cancer, but psychologically, I act like I don't.
Let's go next to Sierra from Madison. Hi, Sierra.
Good morning. I'd like to thank the guest for her important and inspiring work. I believe you said that many Europeans are embracing the precautionary principle. And I was really excited to hear that because I've been researching climate change for over 10 years, and this is the first time in a long time that I've heard that principle referred to in the media. And so I would like to ask if you could review for the listeners what this principle means, and if you could tell us what exactly these European people are doing. Is there something official regarding this principle that they're doing? Thanks again.
Sure. Yeah, I'd be delighted. First of all, I sit on the board of a wonderful organization that is the torchbearer for the precautionary principle here in the United States. And the name of that organization is Science and Environmental Health Network. And you can go to the website, sehn.org. And in fact, there's a brand new report out. Our executive director, Carolyn Raffensperger, is an environmental attorney, and the legal director, Joseph Goose, is an attorney and a PhD biochemist, and then our medical director, Ted Shetler, is a physician. And so they are formulating ways in which the precautionary principle can be implemented here in the U.S., and the way in which our legal system is either similar or different from what's going on in Europe. So take a look, Science and Environmental Health Network, SEHN.org. And then in Europe, I can say that, yes, the precautionary principle has actually been enshrined into the Constitution of the European Union and is at work in all kinds of, you know, informs all, and inspires all kinds of progressive environmental decision-making. And you might want to check out a good website there called... the Chemicals Health Monitor. They're kind of the big group throughout the European Union that is advocating for the implementation of the precautionary principle across environmental decision-making is a group called the Health and Environment Alliance.
And on that note,
Environment Alliance.
We have to say goodbye because we're out of time. I'm sorry. Sandra, thank you so much for being with us this hour.
You're welcome. What a pleasure.
Thank you. Our guest this hour is Sandra Steingraber, and her piece, her recent piece, is in the current issue of Orion Magazine, which if you've never seen it, is really a gorgeous piece. Or you can go to orionmagazine.org. She's also the author of Living Downstream, An Ecologist Looks at Cancer and the Environment. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Rob Schroeder for production. And this is the Ideas Network.